has been found by police looking for the missing schoolgirl Tia Sharp. The discovery was made at her grandmother's house in New Addington in South London, where the 12-year-old was last seen. Officers had been searching the property this afternoon. Our crime correspondent Martin Brunt says they're now trying to find Stuart Hazel, the partner of Tia's grandmother.
The man who has been questioned twice as a witness, the man who said he was here last Friday at midday when Tia told him she was off on a shopping trip and left. He says that was the last he saw of her.
Mark Williams Thomas is a criminologist who spoke to Stuart Hazel this week.
I was in that house and I was on the ground floor. I did ask to go into Tia's bedroom, and actually I wanted to film in Tia's bedroom, and they said no, nobody's been in there and no one's going to go in there since until she's found.
In other news, China's state news agency is reporting the wife of a once powerful politician in the country has admitted that she was behind the death of a British businessman. Neil Haywood was found dead in his hotel room in November. A soldier from 3rd Battalion the Rifles has been killed in Afghanistan, his family has been told. Shares in Manchester United have started trading in New York. The club's trying to raise £150 million. The money will be used to pay down its debts and half will go to the owners. Team GB Sailors Luke Patience and Stuart Bithell say they're delighted to have picked up an Olympic silver medal. They were edged off top spot by the Australian pair in the medal race of the 470 class. Patience says hard work has paid off.
We have sailed the regatta of our lives and we've come out here this week and we've jumped onto the world circuit, our first Olympics, first time Olympians, and sailed better than we could have asked of ourselves.
Elsewhere, the game's big disappointment for Team GB in the BMX. Sinead Reid finished sixth in her final, while Liam Phillips crashed during the men's version. The women's hockey team have claimed a bronze, though. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Robin Clapp from the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance and me, Tony Gosling. It's a case of beggar thy neighbour. The council doesn't want it, but they're trying to stop the local people using it too. The old South Bristol College site on Marksbury Road in Bedminster looks set to have its thriving local community groups and some small businesses too told to leave in February, even though the council has no particular plans for it. So why are our community-owned buildings not for the community anymore? Plus, an old soldier asked the British Army to reinstate a Polish officer 65 years after he was sacked, and he believes scapegoated in September 1944, blamed for the famous failure of the Bridge Too Far operation in Arnhem. Well, before we get into that, though, there's been obviously lots going on around the world. Robin Clapp from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance is still with us. Now, Robin, we've had an assault over the last week and a half or so in the town of Aleppo, which is the biggest city actually in Syria. What are your thoughts about what's been going on there? I think yesterday they finally admitted, the Free Syrian Army, that they were going to have to pull out.
Well, it's clear that the Assad regime has staked an awful lot on removing the Free Syrian Army from Aleppo and trying to regain the initiative. Militarily, the situation is becoming more bloody by the day. There are over 40 generals now from the Syrian army, almost all of whom are Sunni generals who've defected. And of course, in the last week, we've had the embarrassment for Assad of his prime minister leaving the country. I think as the situation becomes more bloody, it's clear that the Free Syrian Army is a very heterogeneous organisation. There are people who are fighting to bring about an Egyptian-style Arab Spring. There are people who are fighting to remove Assad without very much idea of what they stand for. And clearly there is an enormous amount of murky involvement by the US. William Hague has issued a statement today saying that more money will be sent by Britain to support the Free Syrian Army for so-called non-military purposes. We have allegations that the Iranian regime is supplying weaponry, that Russia is supplying weaponry, and so on. It's the people in Syria, ultimately, who will determine their own fate, unlike the situation in Iraq, where the Western powers were very bellicose and said, we'll go in and sort it out and impose a democracy. I think they all realise that to go into Syria would be an entirely different and very, very complicated question. But nevertheless, we have to oppose any military involvement of any sort by Britain, America, or indeed any of the other cynical world powers who are looking at what is happening in Syria more from the point of view of defending their own status quo and their own privileges rather than bringing about the general and genuine liberation of the Syrian people.
Well, one of the things that disturbed me most about over the last week or so, maybe 10 days, is the assault by the Free Syrian Army on the TV and radio station in Aleppo, which is quite a big building, and quite clearly, attacking that specifically because they don't like what's coming out of the TV stations. There is actually one guy who's Mohammed al-Said. He was kidnapped by the Free Syrian Army and actually executed. What the Free Syrian Army afterwards said was they didn't like what he was saying on the television. This doesn't really bode well, does it, for what the new Syria is going to look like if the Free Syrian Army win? It may be something more like what's happened in Libya, where you have really, a long period of time with no rule of law.
I think there is every prospect of a chaotic situation unfolding in Syria. It's happening already. And unless there emerges an ideology based around actually trying to unite the Syrian people, trying to reach out to both Sunnis, Alawites, and all the other ethnic minorities around a social program that actually raises expectations of a better future than the one they've had under the Assad regime, then there will be a splintering of that country. And the parallel with Libya is very apt, because Libya, we're told, was liberated from Gaddafi, but the situation in Libya is that you have an ungovernable country at the present time with all sorts of rivalries and different groups competing against each other, all of which ultimately like to take a rake off for themselves, often over the heads of the very people they claim to be liberating and supporting.
We just
have to keep stating that the real liberators of Syria will be the ordinary people. They need to organise themselves.
The only trouble is, Robin, they don't have the guns, do they? The Al-Nusra Front stated in one of four communiques posted on Islamist forums on the 3rd of August, it had kidnapped this TV presenter in Damascus province on the 19th of July and killed him after subjecting him to interrogation. They said, perhaps this operation and others will serve as an example to all who support this tyrannical regime, so they may repent to God, they quoted the militant group as saying in a statement. Otherwise, the swords of the Mujahideen will cut off their heads and purify Syria from their obscenity. Now, this sort of talk is getting pretty scary, and I wonder, I don't know what your thoughts are, whether NATO, to a certain extent, and William Hague are actually egging them on in these kind of sentiments, that what they're doing is somehow like a crusade for God.
Well, I think NATO has to be very, very careful about any egging on and any aid they give to these groups because of the disparate nature of these groups. I mean, there is never on the part of Britain or the US or NATO a genuine inclination to support ordinary people to overthrow dictators. It always comes with strings attached. And you have the intervention of Al-Qaeda, you have the intervention of homegrown right-wing political Islamists who have their own agenda. And in the chaos that presently exists, the first thing that seems to be probable is that sooner or later the Assad regime will fall. But as to whether that will be then accompanied by genuine elections in which the people of Syria can forge a new society based on the kind of society I'm sure many ordinary people desire, a society based on freedom, democracy, jobs,
well,
and so on.
I mean, they've recently
very unlikely.
Well, they've recently had a referendum in Syria about 2 months ago, which was on the constitution, which got actually around about 75% of the people saying yes, they did want this new kind of constitution. So to a certain extent, Assad does seem to have a fair amount of support. There is a wide support. It's not as if it's one of the countries where the leader is really hated within his own country. There certainly seems to be a majority of people there who would much rather things were just carried on as they have over the last 10 years, even if the leader isn't perfect. We'd much rather that than have a civil war.
Well, there are certainly people for whom voting against the Assad regime would be a very dangerous step, and so perhaps some of those people vote holding their noses. There is still, as you say also, people who would prefer order over chaos, of course. Most people can see that a chaotic civil war of the sort we saw unfold in Iraq or in Libya, or even in some respects now in Egypt, where the different strains and pressures between the military and the newly elected president are revealing many acts of hostility against people indiscriminately very often. Nobody would want that sort of thing, but I would be sceptical about whether if we had some of the Syrian people who voted for Assad here in the studio in safe conditions, whether they would have the same ringing endorsement of the Assad regime. You must remember that the Assad regime has been in place since 1970. It is a regime that demands complete loyalty. Of course, among the Alawites, who represent a minority but form the clan from which the Assad regime come themselves, there is no doubt a material reason for them supporting Assad, because they fear that the fall of Assad will mean pogroms against them and so on. And so one of the important things that genuine forces in Syria have to do is reassure minorities of all sorts that a new Syria is not going to be discriminatory, is not going to actually take reprisals and so on. But without a force on the ground that can bring about that unity, I would argue the working class through the trade unions that exist in Syria are best placed to play that role, and they appear at the moment not to be doing so prominently. But unless you have some form of united front that has a secular and tolerant approach to the questions that are going to face a new Syria, then I'm afraid more bloodshed seems imminent and inevitable.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, the great festival to Zeus is nearly finished. I'm talking, of course, about the Olympics. That was the original idea of the Olympics back in ancient Greece. Zeus was the guy that it was all done for. And that's nearly finished. But we have seen over the last week or so some interesting couples, that is to say, media barons and politicians, schmoozing at the Olympics. And this was this excellent report from last Saturday, a little version of it, on Channel 4 News, where one of their Olympics reporters spotted various people arriving and together and holding hands at the Olympics. And so let's have a listen to that now.
You can learn a lot about Britain's power elite by just hanging by the poolside of an evening, watching people coming and going on the service road into the aquatic centre. Look, there's Tony Blair and Tessa Jowell. Cherie is in the car. There's Will and Kate, looking radiant. We were here, though, because Rupert Murdoch was coming by invitation of Boris Johnson. There is talk that Mr. Murdoch fancies Boris Johnson as the next PM.
Little love-in with Rupert by the pool today?
As you know, Porrick, we have an extensive programme to welcome people from around the world to London.
Does he want Rupert you to be Murdoch, Prime Minister? Rupert is that Murdoch. Going to be the chat around the pool today?
Rupert Murdoch is a massive investor in sport in this country and in this city. And
what's he like?
He's a, as I say, he's a very, very
as a person,
investor,
I mean,
very, very big investor in London and in.
Is he a nice guy?
And I want to make sure that we get investment in our city. That's my job.
Time for home. Mr. Murdoch and his wife Wendy come out looking for their car.
Mr. Murdoch! Up here!
For a moment, he seems to mistake me for his chauffeur.
Hello?
Oh no, just another annoying hack.
Do you want Boris Johnson to be Prime Minister? Hands up if you do!
And still, no sign of his driver. Then Wendy spots the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, Jeremy Hunt. So, what have we learnt about the powerful? Not a great deal, to be honest. They get the best tickets in town. And some conservative big guns don't think Rupert Murdoch sufficiently toxic to avoid being seen with in public.
Well, Robin Clapp from Bristol District Anti-Cuts Alliance, I suppose that's the main point, really. What we've got there is we've got the Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt holding hands with Rupert Murdoch, a nice seat round the pool at the Olympics. I mean, do you think he's really totally impartial there?
Well, Jeremy Hunt found out again. He does seem to pop up in the most inconvenient places, doesn't he? And more worryingly from his point of view, he seems to either get caught on camera or have his emails looked at, which show that him and Rupert are in a bit of a love-in. This is the neoliberal Olympics, so why wouldn't Rupert Murdoch be there? This Olympic Games has been all about the self-aggrandisement of Boris Johnson. The Tories and even the Lib Dems have tried to jump on the bandwagon and claim that Britain is doing wonderfully well, and it's a bit of a masquerade to take us away from all the other problems. You know, the Romans had their circuses, David Cameron's got his Olympics. Of course, he can't resist then saying that the problem is that comprehensive schools don't have sports fields and don't get youngsters doing 2 hours of compulsory sport every week, and Johnson says they should do 2 hours. This rowing centre at Eton Dorney that we've all been marvelling at, that was built entirely for Eton School. Let's see that opened up to comprehensive kids across the country. The truth is Michael Gove's closing the school playing fields all around the country, just as the last New Labour government did. And so it's the neoliberal Olympics. There have been some great athletic performances, some fantastic and very humble athletes who've worked very, very hard for their medals. But I think that we have McDonald's, we have the other big brands all lining up, taking their share. And if this were 2006 rather than 2012, we would see every rich banker in Britain sat in the front row of those Olympic seats as well. But of course, they're persona non gratis at the moment. They're kept in the back rows, very probably. Rupert Murdoch in town again. Yeah, big surprise. Rupert Murdoch, Boris Johnson. Of course, he wants him to be Prime Minister. And
Rupert Murdoch, another question. Half his staff, it seems, have been charged with criminal offences now, at last, after all this time. And but he still feels, I mean, it seems he's got off scot-free. He still feels confident enough to go meet Jeremy Hunt at the Olympics and also hold the hand of Boris Johnson, who, it seems, may be being tipped as the next Prime Minister. Yeah. Certainly if Rupert Murdoch has his way.
Well, yes, it will be fascinating over the next few months when Rebecca Wade and all the other people around Rupert Murdoch are forced to stand in the dock and explain what they didn't know about the business that they were running. Of course, Rupert Murdoch says he can't remember very much. The truth is that anybody who has spent even a couple of minutes looking at the Murdoch scandal would find it incredible to believe that the people running News Corp weren't giving a very clear lead to their journalists about what to do. So, you know, Rupert Murdoch, yeah, he's innocent until proven guilty, if you believe that rain comes up instead of down.
Okay, thanks. And finally, what about the ice whole point of this being really, has Rupert Murdoch, do you think, got off scot-free from the Leveson inquiry and for the phone hacking crisis? Because it seems, like I say, he's confident now. He's out there in public, a guest of Boris Johnson, and holding hands with Jeremy Hunt.
I don't think the Leveson inquiry will do anything in terms of Rupert Murdoch, apart from make some perhaps quite harsh comments on paper about he should have been more awake on his watch and so on. Yes, he does feel confident. That's part of the man's image. I mean, he's brazening it out. He knows that he's got stuff on Boris Johnson and the Tories and that they need him like he needs them. They're all in it together, as I always say. You know, it's not the country in it helping to solve the deficit, it's the rich in it against the rest of us. And Boris Johnson gives him tickets to the London Olympics. Rupert Murdoch is just getting favours repaid for favours he's no doubt given to Boris Johnson, and Boris Johnson wants him and his newspapers and his media to come out and support him against David Cameron or against whoever the candidates are when the next Tory leadership election takes place.
Well, one of the announcements during the Olympics was that Education Secretary Michael Gove has approved the sale of over 20 school playing fields. Precisely. Since the coalition government took office, it's emerged total 21 out of 22 requests have been given the go-ahead by the Department for Education in the last 2 years, with one more still under consideration. I mean, what does that tell you about their commitment to sport?
Well, it tells you that the Tories are carrying on the policies that the Labour Party carried on in terms of selling off playing fields. But whereas under the new Labour government there was investment in sport, this government is hypocritically cutting back the sport budget hugely for schools. One of Gove's first acts was to actually put the axe to the school sports funding budget. When I was a school governor, my school, along with every other primary and secondary school in Bristol, benefited from that budget. And all this nonsense about, you know, teachers must teach competitive sports. We had really good competitive sports, inter-school football and netball competitions. Many schools now, struggling with budgets that are getting smaller, are having to forego sport. And the other thing, of course, is the same Michael Gove who says that there must be more emphasis on sport is beefing up the Ofsted inspection process and sending in Ofsted inspectors to put the frighteners on schools that are so-called not doing as well as they should be with their exam results, with their SATs tests and so on. And so a lot of heads, coupled with smaller budgets and the fear that they're going to be forced to become academies if they don't raise academic standards to the arbitrary level that Michael Gove insists on, are letting sport go by the wayside. So this Olympic legacy of sport for everyone is in effect a legacy of sell off the school playing fields, make it just as difficult as it's always been for ordinary working class kids to do a lot of the sports that maybe they would love to do but don't have the facilities to do. It's easy to play football. You put down a couple of jumpers to make a goal post, you need a ball. To participate in some of these other sports, the rowing, the canoeing, the dressage or whatever, you've got to have a bit of money behind you, you've got to belong to a club, and you've got to be motivated in your school. And if Michael Gove and David Cameron put the money and the effort into giving kids opportunities across the board to participate in sport instead of closing school playing fields and selling them off, yes, we might have a real legacy. As it is, this will be known as the neoliberal Olympics, and you know, Rupert Murdoch was the man who came along to put his stamp of approval on what has been an Olympics that, whilst very good for the athletes and as a spectacle, nevertheless is an exhibition of all that's grotesque about this society's priorities.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, Bristol City Council have just put the old South Bristol College site on Marksby Road in Bedminster up for sale by tender. But after all the bids were in, how many is Property Services' little secret, none were considered good enough for the council to sell the site. Well, this leaves everyone in a dilemma. The college has been thriving since it was closed and many different small businesses and not-for-profit groups are using it. Even though the council won't be selling the site, Property Services have decided they won't be renewing the present management group lease with Artspace Lifespace when it comes up for renewal in February. So for all the community groups, they will be forced to abandon the site to Budlier, vandals possibly, and even the bulldozer. Anyway, I'm joined now by one person who does admit to putting in a bid for the site, which was rejected by the council. That's David Parks. Hi, David. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, for those who've not been there, because it's tucked away a little bit, where is the South Bristol College site?
It's the other side of Bedminster, the south side. And it's just off St John's Lane, so it sort of links between areas of South Bristol, Bedminster, Totterdown, Windmill Hill and Knoll. And it's an enormous site, which includes, in fact, in terms of what's been put up for sale, some of the northern slopes, which a lot of the local residents will know and have used as an amenity, walking their dogs, etc., for a long time. So it's not just the college. It's all public sector land. The council, bless them, and a government agency have pulled their land holdings together and said, right, here's an opportunity for a developer to come in and do something. You know, we were just talking, weren't we, about selling off playing fields. It's the same story, I think. Mm. You know, on the one hand, you've got the government looking, recognising that we are in an austerity drive for cash. And on the other hand, they're saying there's this thing called Localism Act, which empowers communities to have responsibility for their own land. These two don't quite fit together, do they, Tony? So we've got a clash.
Can you just talk about the, give us a description of the site. What sort of variety of buildings are there on there?
We've got a fantastic old college campus. I say old college campus. Some of the buildings there are less than 10 years old. We have a wonderful workshop block. We have a sports centre there, and we have on this site an original building which was a school, which is interesting because there is a requirement for a school in the South Bristol area. And this was a secondary school before it became a college. And these are really good buildings. And so we've got about 6.5 acres of college buildings. Many of them can be reused. That's a very sustainable view, isn't it? Rather than just knocking these down. And I think what we have to do is to stop thinking about, okay, this is a site in which we can just reduce everything to rubble, start again, and create the same old, same old.
Well, I mean, for most people, it's housing, yeah. That's right. I mean, yeah. A lot of these places have been flattened and houses built on them where the local community haven't sort of stepped in and tried to stop it. Okay, so when was it closed?
About 3 years ago. And it is an important part of the community infrastructure. And there's not a huge amount of community infrastructure in this area. So many of the local residents I've met either have worked at the college or they went to the college and they know it. And it's not, as North Street, Bedminster might be, an area that has a lot of facilities, doesn't have a lot of social facilities or retail facilities. So this is, you know, just to lose this would be a travesty, I think, for this area. And what we need to do is to build on it, but in a way that respects the value of what we got there, and create something that has value going forward, not just I mean, we are in probably the largest housing estate in Bristol, in South Bristol. So why would we want to build another one in the middle of it? It just seems madness, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, what about, has anyone else actually admitted publicly to bidding for the site? Because I know you put a bid together.
Yes, we did. We were encouraged to. I mean, we started as a campaign group because we simply saw this as an opportunity to do something better than just hand this over to a house builder just to do, as we were saying, to start again and create an estate development that means nothing to nobody. So we saw this as a tremendous opportunity, which was totally in line with all the government rhetoric about doing things differently, sustainability, involving the community. And we started as a campaign group. We then tried to influence the landowners, Bristol City Council and the Homes and Community Agency, to be a little bit ambitious in terms of their plans, rather than just simply selling this off, which, frankly, Tony, you could do or I could do or, you know, anyone.
But I think, so, I mean, the way I understand it, that property services work when they do sell buildings off is that they will look at all the different bids and they will compare them. They will say, well, this one here has got a massive community benefit, but they've bid a little bit less. And then they might take a bid like that because they are considering both. They're considering what would the benefit be to the city as well as just the financial gain to them.
You might think. I have been working in property, Tony, for 30 years, and I recognise that a site such as this, and there are many up and down the country, are not ideal for a standard house builder, for a number of reasons. It's a low value area, it's a difficult site, it's on a steep slope. The community don't want a housing estate. There are a number of reasons.
But I mean, with all that, you know, there's actually, even the house builders are finding it difficult to borrow money to get these developments going.
And it's no surprise to me that the house builders didn't come in here. So what we did, we put in a bid, and that was a very, it was a valid bid. We have enormous support, commercial partners to deliver this. And it's like Team GB at the Olympics being excluded because the opposition didn't turn up. You know, I mean, it's an absurd situation.
So tell us a bit about the people you were working with on the bid then. Who did you have alongside you?
Okay, well, we've consulted with the community for probably best part of a year. We have brought together some partners. We've been working with Steiner School. We've been working with, because we recognised there was a requirement for a school there. We've been working with the local GPs who've been sitting in absolutely almost decrepit premises for years, and the PCT recognised they're top of the list to go on to new property. And we thought, why is nobody doing something about this? So we worked with the local GPs who supported our bid, and we worked with some inspired developers, investors who kind of aren't cut out of the mould of Barrett's or Persimmon, but really understand what we are trying to do. What we're trying to do is to create a community-owned development, bottom-up development, that would ultimately be owned by the community, but would also enable that community to be involved in the design and even the construction, because now, we're also talking about self-built housing and so on.
Well, you say owned by the community. Yeah. How does that work then? Because, I mean, when we think of that, we think of the council.
Yeah, I suppose some do. But this, through a structure called a Community Land Trust, which is at the top of the HCA, government department, are one of the landowners, and the Minister for Housing heads that organisation, that government quango, and he's been saying we need a self-build revolution in Britain, and this is an opportunity, and the structure that fits for this would be a community land trust, and he's directed the community agency to look at CLTs or community land trusts as models. That means the community own the title to the estate. And of course, if you took a house there, then you would own your bit, but the whole of the land, which includes the allotments, the open areas, the car park, the facilities, the sports hall, that would all be owned by the community organisation. And that would derive an income from ground rents and be self-supporting. And could do amazing things in terms of providing housing, in terms of supporting new businesses, because this is, I think, if I'm right, what the message we're getting from government, from the Penthouse, which is you get on and do and we will back you 100%. What we find in practice, we have got on and done, and we've done that without any government support at all, and we've not been backed by the agency of government. So the Yes Minister crew, who are effectively the gatekeepers, on this occasion we feel didn't have the guts to really go for this.
Well, this is annoying, isn't it? Because you've put a lot of time and creative energy into this, and they've just thrown it back in your face. Ultimately, though, they are the owners. I mean, if is there any way you can say maybe even go through the politicians to try and get at property services to get them to take you more seriously? Because we're now looking at it closing in February and becoming, overgrown, you know, sort of Budleer and everything taking it over, windows being smashed and this kind of thing, which is a total waste.
Who owns it? I mean, this is public land in my eye. It doesn't matter whether it's the council or the government, it's public land. And I think we have to take responsibility for public land, and not just say, well, they own it, they being the council or they being the government or they being the agency that's actually got it in its portfolio.
Well, fair play to you, because I think there's somebody else's job syndrome often comes in with these sorts of sites, and you're saying, well, it's either the council or someone else's job to sort of look after this place. Actually, you know, fair play to you for coming in and saying, well, no, you know, we're going to keep this for the community, because we don't actually necessarily think the council are the best people to be the landlords there.
Absolutely. And this is, as I said, this is echoing everything. So everything we're being told, we're ticking the boxes, we're going, yes, okay, we get that, we will do that. And so we've put forward this amazing opportunity. We've brought commercial partners who have real money, real resources, real expertise behind it, to demonstrate we can deliver it. And there is absolutely no reason why we can't go forward. And the sad thing, Tony, is that Bristol has been thrown out, or came second on the Copenhagen Green Capital City Awards. And this is just the sort of thing that we should be promoting, that this city, which is so amazing and has such great roots initiatives, and, you know, I have to say, well, okay, if that's the response from the current regime, we have to look to the mayor and say, okay, will a guy in post on November the 15th actually wake up and see the opportunity? Because the opportunity for Bristol is that it has the largest, most significant sustainable development in Britain, if not Europe. And there are other schemes in Holland, Almere, which the housing minister went to very recently, in Germany. We don't have it here. We need to show that we can do this, and that we can provide affordable housing for people who don't have the luxury of capital. We can provide sustainable homes. We can provide facilities for local people without going through the machinery of government to do it. We can do all of this.
Okay, well, look, take us on a little virtual tour around the site. Tell us about some of the groups that are using it at the moment and that you envisage maybe able to use it with, if your plan succeeds, into the future.
Well, as you say, ArtSpace have a license from the Homes and Community Agency, who own the college, to occupy that. And I think that's a two-way advantage, in that a site like that costs a lot of money to keep the security going when it's empty and mothballed. So ArtSpace are actually doing a favour, I think, to the landowner in that respect. But they're also giving a lot to the community and providing facilities. So we have there an amazing skateboard park run by a Duracell battery called Andre, who completely connects with the kids there. I think they've got 200 or 300 members coming in for to skateboard and to scooter. They have a number of arts organisations there, studios, businesses, and obviously it's at low rents, people can afford it. So it's a fantastic creative environment. But behind that, we have a huge area of open space, the northern part of the Northern Slopes, which have been designated for sale. Now, rather than saying, OK, how much development can we get on that, which would be a traditional response, we say, OK, well, that's a part of the infrastructure of the community. Can we introduce development without disrupting that?
What's the answer?
Well, we think we can, absolutely. We think we've made the case for that. We'd like to be heard. We've invited the council and the executive to meet with us on the site to talk about it. We've been trying to get those meetings for many, many, many months and found it very difficult to get.
What about the local councillors that are for that area? Have they been on side and have they been taking an interest in your plans?
I'd like to put credit where credit's due to Mark Bailey, who has turned up at many meetings, and I think that's been a constructive dialogue. Other councillors, frankly, just haven't been there, so that's disappointing. But ultimately, the decision, as far as the council is concerned, is on one guy's desk, and that's the council member with Portfolio for Planning and Regeneration, which is Councillor Negus. We've tried to have many meetings with Mr. Negus.
You found it very difficult, yeah.
We have found it difficult.
Okay, so now we're in a situation with ArtSpace, LifeSpace. Can you tell us a little bit about these people? Because they sound quite interesting to me. So they have been able to move into this and done a little deal with the Homes and Communities Agency to say that we will be your sort of, rather than you just paying for security to look after this place, well, we all know where that leads to. We will actually manage the space. We had a guy called Tony Crofts on here a few weeks ago explaining that there are literally hundreds of thousands of square feet of empty non-residential space in the city. This is would have just added to that. What are ArtSpace, LifeSpace able to actually do with spaces like the South Bristol College site? Because this is one of the things that actually I think is a criminal waste. We've got masses of space out there. We've also got lots and lots of young, particularly young, unemployed people who just need some space in order to get on, maybe to start a business, maybe to use it as potentially art, a kind of art studio, that kind of thing. And what have they been able to achieve there?
Well, I think most people will perhaps... I'm sorry ArtSpace weren't here today, but they will perhaps be best known in Bristol with their association with the Invisible Circus, who put on fantastic performances from their occupation of Bridewell Island, because they had one of the iconic buildings they occupied in Bristol where was the old police station, the fire station, where they started to weave their sort of creative magic with some performances around Carnival and so on. So I think they've got a fantastic reputation in Bristol. They're now part of the organisation that's looking at occupying Creative Common and the big top tent behind the station. They are one of a number of grassroots organisations who are really getting recognised, have a huge amount of community support. And I'm very pleased to see organisations like the council and Homes and Community Agency and others recognising the value that they give. So they have taken these facilities with enormous energy and opened those up for people to use. And you're absolutely right. As long as these things are mothballed, then they just simply deteriorate and they become an irrelevance to the community. So we need to bring these buildings back into use, rather than just doing the same old, same old. And they are one way in which we can facilitate that.
Okay. Now, also, will it really close in February?
Well, that's when ArtSpace's licence expires, as I understand. I can't see it. The council is talking about putting a school on the site, which is interesting because I believe there's been a requirement for a school in South Bristol for 3 years, since 2009, I understand. So why a school wasn't put into the brief that the landowners put it out for this, it is amazing. It's staggering. It's as if one side of the council has only just woken up to the other side of the councils. Now, that would be a surprise, wouldn't it, Tony?
Well, I think there's quite a lot of big corporations of various sorts, or even fairly small ones, that don't talk to each other. Obviously, Barclays do. I mean, they were talking to each other about LIBOR when they shouldn't have been. But, you know, one of these departments may not just simply not be in touch with the other one. It doesn't really say a lot for whether the city council is actually an efficient unit when it's not joined up thinking.
It's not joined up thinking. And you know, the thing that I find really amazing is that the council did a full community consultation in this area on that site 2-3 years ago, and out of that came 13 very clear objectives from that community, and that included a school. Now, at the time, they said there is no requirement for a school, but when there was a requirement for a school. So these things don't quite add up. The community objectives were also sustainable development, preservation of existing buildings, protection of habitats, youth facilities, employment facilities. In fact, a lot of those proposals have been weaved into the proposal we put up in this tender.
But hang on a minute, because your proposal, surely the problem was almost certainly the bottom line, which is cash. Is they're thinking, look, if we hang on a bit, then we're going to get some big developer come and give us much more cash, much more than David can.
Well, it's interesting because this tender process, which is a nightmare, it's a European procurement process. This first stage didn't require us to put a bid forward. It required us to explain how we would deliver something. So how much cash we had, not how much cash we were offering for the site, how much cash and balance sheet and resources and expertise in delivering, frankly, standard housing. So we had to tick all these boxes, but we weren't asked to make a bid for the site at this stage. That was going to be the next stage. Now, what has clearly happened is that we've put a lot of effort into it. The house builders run for the hills because of the reasons we've talked about, and I think, you know, they may have had one or two other expressions of interest, but maybe no other valid serious bids. So they weren't able to take this into a competition and say, okay, you four guys, line up and give us your best bid. Now, we can get over that. Of course we can. We've got this here now ready to deliver, and frankly, the response that we'll mothball this and come back in a year's time and try again is not, I think when anyone sees this close, if ArtSpace move out, we've got to ask the question, why on earth are we waiting for something to happen here when we've had this offer of really doing something amazing?
What about you? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your own background. Have you got any experience of doing this kind of thing?
Well, many, many years. I have to say with some embarrassment, I was involved, for example, on the Harbourside project, and that really convinced me that we were going in completely the wrong direction, because there was probably the best regeneration opportunity in the country, if not Europe, and look what we did. And it's exactly
luxury housing, basically.
Exactly what we've been fighting against. So exactly the same procurement process. The landowners, including Bristol City Council, put it out, appointed Cress Nicholson as the single developer, a house builder, and look what we had. If anybody's proud of that, please ring in and do whatever. Sorry, I was running around taking you to, but I have not heard anybody say a good word about Harbourside, because it was not community driven, it was not community designed, it's got no sustainability context, and that's what we're trying to put right. We've got to do better, learn by our mistakes. So
surely, I mean, what I'm saying then, it may be right about the money side of things if they have a consultation, then just go for the highest bidders with some luxury housing.
Well, I think we're entering a new age. I hope so, because you know, otherwise, you know, the many, many people, and we've got 700-800 people behind us, and that's just a start. But you know, people recognise that we've got to stop doing that crazy thing. I've been working in property for 30 years. I was a director at DTZ, and I was responsible for advising a lot on a number of.
What's DTZ?
DTZ is a property consultancy, an international property consultancy, but based in Bristol. So yes, I do have a bit of experience in development funding.
Well, one of your local residents is sitting with us. It's Robin Clapp from the Anti-Cuts Alliance. Robin, I'd just like to bring you in here. What are your thoughts? I mean, obviously you know the site, being just literally virtually on the same road. What are your thoughts about what you've heard?
Well, I think David's put forward a really compelling case for how that site could be sustainable and used inventively, and how it presently is being used inventively, involving young people, involving the community. I was the chair of the local community association back in 2004 up to 2010, when we first got wind of the news that the college was going to close. We were extremely angry at the time that the college was closing, because it was another very important resource being taken out of an area which most people who visit the Marksbury Road estate would agree is a very neglected part of Bedminster and South Bristol. We need regeneration, not the taking out of resources. Initially, the plan was to turn it into a new housing estate. And I attended, on behalf of the Marksbury Area Community Association, along with others, several meetings and conferences with developers who were coming down and telling us what they were going to build. And we had a great sense that this was not the way we wanted to go. And I remember back in 2005, 2006, actually discussing with some of these people that the concept of luxury housing on the Marksbury Road estate was completely at variance with the real world. And did these people know what they were talking about? And
well, in a way, isn't it interesting the way that the economy has sort of kicked in and made sure that there isn't going to be luxury housing on the Marksbury Road, because the house builders simply won't be able to get the cash to do it?
Well, the other thing, Tony, is that wearing yet another of my hats, I was the chair of one of the local school governing bodies, and 5 or 6 years ago we were told that there were too many places in the local area for primary and secondary people, that we didn't need any schools. And now, of course, they've done a 180 degree turn. There are too few places. They want to build new schools. And again, you know, you have to question the council officers in terms of, do they know the area? Do they know the demographic of the area? Because it was evident to me as a school governor 5 or 6 years ago that we were going to have a population growth in this area, because lots of new housing has gone up in the Marksbury Road area. Lots of young families need school places. And so, you know, my plea would be, for goodness sake, let's have some planning. But that planning has to be community-driven planning. We want the experts, we want the specialists, we want the visionaries on board, but the community is part of that process. And the idea that it's going to lie fallow after February fills me with horror. And I think it would be a condemnation of this council. I think Negus and the others need to get their A to Zs out, come across, find out where the Marksbury Road estate is, look at the site, see the brilliant things that are happening, and take seriously the comments that David has made about sustaining a community rather than allowing a community to disappear and dry up.
I see. Now, David, yeah, I just really wanted you to sum up, really, for people who are listening, who are interested in sort of supporting the bid. Well, they've got a few months, haven't they, to go down and actually use the site and enjoy it and have a look around. But what should people do if you're interested in supporting what you're up to?
We do hold tours and meetings. We're going to have a big meeting in early September, and I will post you some information on that. I think it's really important we all come together and we don't kind of see this as a, you know, just a bit of Marksbury Road or a bit of that. You know, this is the whole of Bristol ought to come together and say this is a fantastic opportunity, the largest self-build project we've put forward plans for in Britain, and making not just homes affordable but involving all of those trade skills in South Bristol, involving people teaching, learning how we build communities in a different way.
Okay, and how do people contact you then to find out?
Okay, BS3 Campus is the name of the project. They can look that, Google that.
Use your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, yep.
Or your favourite search engine, yes. So that's the best way to get into the project. We have a petition online. They can join. We would welcome anybody who's interested. Get involved. Give me a ring. Get in touch through the website. If you've got skills, if you haven't got skills, if you're interested, we'd love to hear from you.
Okay, David, thanks very much.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, following on from our investigation into the Arnhem campaign, Operation Market Garden, we concluded it was not a bridge too far, but rather a bridge not far. I've been talking to one of the few surviving soldiers from the British 1st Airborne Division that hung on by their fingernails at the Arnhem Bridge, waiting for the reinforcements that never arrived. Some of the most heroic figures in that battle were the Polish Parachute Brigade, who were dropped as reinforcements, but their commanding officer, General Sosabowski, was afterwards blamed for the operation going so horribly wrong. Major Tony Hibbert, retired of the 1st Airborne, who took over when Colonel John Frost was injured defending the Arnhem Bridge, spoke to me about the contribution of the Polish Brigade earlier this month.
I'm Tony Hibbert. I first met General Sosabowski in 1943 when he was commanding the independent Polish Parachute Brigade. He had been a hero to the Poles ever since the end of the First World War. He had been fighting for the freedom of Poland, fighting against the Russians and the Austrians and again the Russians and finally against the Germans. And Sosabowski escaped from prison and led about 5,000 free Poles through France when France sued for peace and came to England, and he offered his Poles to the Brits to join us in the struggle against Hitler.
Okay, so what kind of person was he?
He was a very impressive person and a fairly short temper, which didn't go down very well with the British generals, most of whom had been to Eton. But in due course, he raised the Polish Parachute Brigade, Number 1 Polish Parachute Brigade, which became Operation Ready for Action at just the time that Arnhem came on the horizon.
Now, there's been quite a lot of criticism of Sosabowski and the Poles' role at Arnhem. Do you think that's justified?
Absolutely not. I was fighting alongside the Poles in and around Arnhem during the battle, and generally speaking, the problem with them is that they would go for any German they saw like a dog after a rat. They hated the Germans, and whatever anyone says, they were always pining for a go at the Germans. To that extent, they were a bit difficult to control. Certainly, during the last 4 days of the action, the Poles alone held the escape line in Operation Berlin, and without this rearguard action, none of our own paras would have escaped. We owe them a lot.
Now, you were involved in a memorial, I think, isn't that right? Can you tell us about that and how that came about?
Yes. After the Battle of Arnhem, General Sosabowski was dismissed by Boy Browning and Montgomery, and he lost also his rank in the army and his pension, and I regret to say that he died a disgraced pauper. There were many in the British parachute regiment who felt that this dismissal was unfair, and a small number of officers, including Brian Eckert and many others, raised a memorial to General Sosabowski to record continuing confidence in the bravery of the brigade and General Sosabowski, and our great regret that he had been unfairly dismissed.
What would you like to see happen now?
We felt at the time that his dismissal was unfair, and with every year that goes by, we feel his dismissal should be rescinded.
Well, Major Tony Hewitt there, who's now in his 90s, talking to me from Cornwall last month, and a real appeal there for Polish-British relations to be mended after an injustice carried out by General Boy Browning and Montgomery at the Arnhem campaign in the Second World War. Well, that's all the second the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours with Live with Spike and Rodsey, and this week Pat Hart, hopefully, who's back from his holidays, inviting you to join him at the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston, also to David Parks from the South Bristol College Development Project, and to Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Next week, we take a look at PFIs. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes us straight to this show and our archives. The podcast is online about 10 minutes after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Music this week from 1976 and Boney M.